All right. Well, thank you all for staying so late. I know it's been a very long day. I'll try and keep my talk a little bit light. The main results I'm going to be talking about are the geometric understanding of L1 regularization, which is similar to it's the same algorithm that Roman spoke about, but viewed from a different lens. So we're going to look at it a different way, looking at primarily high-dimensional geometry and convex polytopes. But I thought, having been sitting in the audience, that maybe it would be nice to spend a few minutes and sort of backtrack and think a little bit about compressed sensing and why it is that there's so much interest in compressed sensing and sort of sketch out qualitatively what's going on with compressed sensing. So hopefully you'll have, a two-slide version of what is compressed sensing, why does it work, and why is it done the way it's done. And then we'll go on to the convex polytope idea. So I guess we could call this lecture zero. Don't make that think that we're going to stay longer. We may even stay shorter. Maybe we'll skip lecture three. Who knows? Okay. So what is the idea? Well, let's first of all fix some notation. So we have a signal y, which is in Rn. So this is some signal of interest, some data, and we have some transform phi, which if we apply it to y, and I'm going to call that x. This is compressive. So being very loose with terminology, has a few large entries. Okay. So you can think of this transform as being Fourier, wavelets, whatever transform you want. Okay. Fine. Now, normally, measurements, so traditional, the measurements that one would take would be either y directly, i.e., you measure by applying the identity matrix times y, or, if you would like, you could also think of measuring directly in whatever transform space you want. So say Fourier space. So you measure the Fourier coefficients directly. These are one of two things you could do. Then you would threshold. And keep only the large coefficients. That's what people would normally do. Okay. Now, the idea with compressed sensing is, well, if you were going to do this anyway, if you knew you were only going to keep a few large coefficients, this is very wasteful. Because this required n measurements. Now, these measurements are very simple, right? The measurements are just done by the identity matrix, and this is how we all think about the way you should go about taking measurements. So it's very comfortable. But, again, it's not very efficient. So the idea of compressed sensing is make fewer measurements. Okay? Now, how are you going to make fewer measurements? Well, what you do is you substitute, instead of measuring with the identity matrix, you substitute in a rectangular matrix. Okay? So let's let A be n, R, little n by big n. So yet again, one more notation, but you're good at this by now. So hopefully that's okay. Now, little n is less than big N, as one would suspect, but it isn't necessarily a lot smaller. So it could be a little bit smaller, say a half or something like this. Or little n could be 0.9 times big N. So it doesn't have to be much, much smaller, just smaller. Okay? So now what we do is instead of measuring this sort of a thing, what we measure is A times phi times y. So in other words, A times x. All right, well, what kind of an A could one do and have this work out well? Well, how about if we chose the identity matrix, but just truncated? So it's little n rows of the identity matrix. How well would that work? So hopefully
hopefully it can be interactive.
It's not going to work out well, right? Why isn't it not going to work out well?
Well, maybe this is overly obvious, or maybe it's not. But the point is that x doesn't have very many entries which are very large. So if you just directly measure points of x with the identity matrix, then usually you'll get entries which aren't very large, which means that you didn't get very much information. So that's not going to work out well. Right? So you can't use that. You can't use something like the identity matrix. So instead, what do you need? Well, what you need is A to be, in some sense, dense. So you need all of the entries to be somehow different from each other, something like this. So you can't have most of them be zero and just one of them be non-zero, like identity, something like that. And what that will allow you to do is you will feel any of the non-zero entries. So for instance, if you had A have all of its entries be Gaussian random, then certainly you somehow capture some information about the large coefficients. Right? So is that clear why one is doing this? So this is the idea of compressed sensing, and it's great in that, in fact, yes, you do capture the essential information in X. The problem is, now that you've made these very strange measurements, how do you recover X? So recover Y or X from B, which is our A, the y, and a. Presumably you should also know phi. Okay. So you need some reconstruction algorithm to do this, and there are many algorithms out there. So you've seen some talks. There's OMP. You could look at L1 regularization. There are many other algorithms out there. You could look at STOMP, which is simultaneous OMP. What are some of the other algorithms out there? So let's see, Condes has a new algorithm which I just saw recently, which is very interesting. So reweighted. So it's some other variant of L1 regularization. And for all of these algorithms, you can certainly think of others. There are many greedy algorithms, as Joel was saying. The whole question is, for B and a class of A, what is the success rate of an algorithm and its computational cost? So, for instance, L1 regularization is quite costly. I mean, we advertise it in the community as being computationally efficient, because it's computationally efficient compared to a combinatorial search, which is completely ridiculous and one can never do. So in some sense, it's computationally efficient, but not very.
So what does it actually cost?
Well, it could cost you n cubed.
So n cubed is?
It could cost you n cubed. If you're smart, you can try to whittle it down. So it comes down to this A. If you know how to make fast matrix vector multiplications with the A, then you could do faster algorithms.
There's even a sublinear time algorithm.
You could even do sublinear algorithms, exactly. So, so for those of you who are in the audience who are new to the area and are thinking of jumping in and working on problems, this is really sort of one of the three problem sets out there. Find an algorithm, come up with a class of A, see how well it works. Prove something about it. Another thing that one can do is you can prove, you can make connections to high dimensional geometry and to classical theory in Banach space. That's an interesting area. Another thing is, these are rather strange measurements, this A, right? So think of what this has done. We've gotten our transform, phi. We've multiplied it by random weights, so we have this random combination of our transform. Let's say the transform is Fourier. Get all the Fourier modes, randomly weight them all, sum it up. That's what you're using your measurements against. So your measurements are against noise. Okay? So how, for a given application, do you build a measurement device which does that, which makes these measurements with essentially noise? So I would say that the easiest example to understand would be application would be a digital camera with a single photodiode, and this was done by Rich Baranook and his team down at Rice. The idea there is, rather than making rather point measurements, you use this sort of randomized measurement again. Well, what is point measurements for a digital camera? Well, you have a collimator, light comes in, and it goes to a bunch of different photodiodes. You have a bank of photodiodes. And each one of them measures what light it sees straight out. That's your digital camera. Well, the idea for the digital camera that uses compressed sensing is you don't have a photodiode for each pixel. Instead, the light comes in and it hits a lens. And this lens is going to give the entry either a weighting of 0 or 1. So that acts as A. It randomly weights each of the entries that come in, and then it hits a lens which focuses. And it focuses, which acts as the inner product, right? Because in the end, we need to make an inner product here. That would be one of the rows of this object here. And then you sum it up. Right? That's what the lens does. So that's one measurement. So for instance, that's a digital camera using compressed sensing, but it's really very different than the way we normally think about things with an identity matrix. Okay. So that was a little digression from what I was planning on speaking on, but I thought it would be nice to sort of backtrack and see where we are and how the talks come into play. So Joel spoke on OMP, Roman on L1, and Anna on sublinear algorithms. All of them sort of motivated by this kind of an idea. So what I've been working on over the last while with Donahoe, all of my results I'll present are with Donahoe, is this. So we wanted to answer the question of, well, so we have to come up with some model for A, and some reconstruction algorithm. So we look at A, which is Gaussian. And we look at the L1 regularization algorithm, and we ask, how well does it work? So this is what we're going to come to. But before we do that, let me give some geometry explaining what is L1 regularization doing, and why does it work? What are the fundamental geometric properties that are causing it to work well? You've seen a plot the L1 ball, give you some idea. Okay, so here we go. Let's talk about convex polytopes. Regularization, somehow the L1 has to come into play. How does it come into play? Well, here's an A. So A is a matrix, little n by big N. So throughout, I'm going to use the notation, which is that the number of non-zeros in X is given by K, and A is in our little n by big N. Now, of course, we are going to have K is going to be less than little n, which is less than big N, but again, not necessarily having them being much less. In fact, people often say that the most interesting case is where K is very small. This is actually not quite the case. The most interesting case is when K is actually quite large. When K is large compared to little n. So you want K to be quite close to little n, which means there's quite a bit of information, but nonetheless, n, which is the number of measurements,
is very close to k. So the number of measurements is quite close to the information content. So we're actually quite interested in the case where k is close to little n. And in some sense, the case we're also interested in is when little n is much smaller than big n. We want to make little n as small as possible. Okay. So here's the convex hull of the matrix A. So we look at all values y that come out from ax for the L1 norm of x, a convex combination of x, being less than or equal to 1. Fine? So let's think about this algorithm minimize over x. Subject to ax equals b. Okay. As an alternative way of viewing this, instead of thinking of it this way, let's think about where we get a, we get its convex hull. We start it being very small. We fix b. Now remember, this b is in R little m. And then rather than minimize, we're going to grow out the convex hull until it intersects with our point of interest, b. So I'll try and keep everything on the chalkboard, but my drawings are really bad, so let's put some of these right here. Okay. So, rather than the minimization problem, we start out by growing the convex hull of A. We fix B. So, over there in blue is our convex hull of A. B is some point in little n dimensional space here. Little n is 3, simply so we can plot things, but of course we're never going to actually be thinking about things in just 3 dimensions. So we have B there, and then we grow the convex hull, and now one of two things is going to happen. Either the convex hull is going to intersect B on a large face, so the largest dimensional face you can have is a 2-dimensional face, or it could hit on a smaller dimensional face. Now, if you randomly pick a B, what's going to happen? Well, it's going to have this property, right? For pretty much any B that you pick, there isn't going to be a sparse representation. So some people, when they look at this problem for the first time, they say, well, this is a strange problem to be solving, because if you randomly give me a B for a given A, then the answer isn't going to be sparse, and that is correct. And it's very easy to see. Imagine just surrounding this by a sphere, and then getting the lower dimensional objects and projecting them out on the sphere, they will always have a measure of 0. So if you randomly pick a B, it won't follow that measure, and it will hit one of these larger dimensional faces. But the problem we're interested in is, what if actually it had a sparse solution? So what if it wasn't n sparse, but it was k sparse for k less than little n? And then, can we recover it? So, we know that we can. We just solve that problem. So we solve the L0 problem. But of course, we can't solve this computationally, so instead we solve that. And then the question of interest is, when, for what, k, value of k, little n, and big n, and you have to have some class of A Gaussian, does L1 recover the sparsest solution? Not approximately, but exactly. So that would be this case here, where it falls on that exterior. Well, to understand this, we have to go back to what it means for a vector to be k sparse. Well, x is, so x has k non-zeros, but x is living in the higher dimensional space. So we have our capital N. What that means is that it lives on some normalized L1 ball,
may as well have the norm be 1. It lives on some normalized L1 ball, and it lives on a k-1 dimensional face of that L1 ball. Okay. That's just the definition of what it means for it to be sparse. Now, what's going to happen is we're going to apply A to the X. And whether L1 minimization works or not is simply given by the property of what happens to that face. So this face has 2 non-zeros, so it's a one-dimensional face. And where it lives on that face tells us what the values of the non-zeros are. Here, one of them would be very large, the other very small. Here, they would switch. In the middle, they're sort of balanced. Now, when we apply A to this, we get the convex hull. So this is just the L1 ball. We get the convex hull of A. Now, it's not just the convex hull of A. I'm going to be a little bit sloppy and tend to call it the convex hull of A. It's actually the convex hull of A, but not just the columns of A, but plus or minus the columns of A, because we want it to be centrally symmetric. So we're considering both the entries could be positive or negative. Now, if it were negative, that would mean it's on the other side of this L1 ball in one of these faces. And the question is, what happened to this face? So X started out here. Well, one of two things will happen. Either it will fall, that face will fall on the exterior of the polytope, okay, or it will fall interior, like this. Very simple. If it falls on the exterior, then if you think back to the prior slide where we grow things out, then yes, of course, it can hit that exterior point, and you can recover the sparsest solution. On the other hand, if it went interior there, then what would happen? Well, if you wanted that particular bead to hit that value, well, what happened is you have to grow out the L1 ball, this convex polytope, grow that out until it hit B, and then keep growing it until B fell on that line, which was interior. Well, that's going to be a larger value of L1 for that X than the minima, which would be on the exterior. So what you would actually get here is it would fall on a high dimensional face. So you would not recover the sparse solution.
So if it falls on the
It's recoverable, but it could be non-unique. Yes. So that's a good question. What happens if, for instance, this face here and that face there get projected in such a way that those two faces actually give you not a simplex, a point with 3. So here you have a triangle. That ends up as a triangle. Let's say this one ends up as the triangle which is next door. So you have those two triangles. If the angle between those is 0, then the answer will not be unique, right? Because you would have 4 points you could search for the solution. So that could happen, depending upon your A. So that goes back to this question. You have to come up with a class of A and ask how well the algorithm is going to work. If A has a lot of entries which are, say, ones and zeros, and it's quite structured and very simple, then you're more likely to run into that problem than if you had, say, the points being selected Gaussian. Then that would be a very, very unlikely event. Any other questions? Okay. Let's see. So hopefully that gives the geometric interpretation. Now what we want to do is essentially prove that. So I sketched it. It should be clear from the drawing. And now we have to prove this sort of thing. Is relatively straightforward, but will probably require a little bit of time. So before I state the theorem that we want to prove, let me state a definition. This is a geometric definition, and that is K neighborhoods. So polytope P with vertices V, I, one to N. Maybe I should be any set Vi for I in lambda with the support of lambda being k is a face of t. Okay. What is this? Take a look at that odd again. Here's a polytope. Let's ask the question about zero neighborliness. So let's say the polytope is zero neighborly. What does that mean? Well, what it means is that all of the vertices are vertices. Okay, fine. That's quite natural. Here are the vertices. Those are points on the exterior of the polytope, all of these corners. Right. What is one neighborly? One neighborly says So one neighborly would mean that you have two points, but we're doing this for any two points. So you grab two points, say this one and this one, you connect it, then that is a face of the polytope. Okay, fine, it is. But notice that if you were to grab, say, this point and a point way over here, then that would not be a face, because the line that connects that would be interior to the polytope. Okay? So in 3D, this seems quite improbable. But in higher dimensions, we will see that actually that is relatively common. K neighborly would mean that you've got K plus one points, so here say three, and you get a face there. And you do this for every set. So this is for all sets. Okay? And this for all.
What would happen to this if A was overdetermined?
Well, what happens if it's overdetermined? If it's overdetermined, then you haven't projected, so you have fewer points than the dimension you're in, right? So you're talking about where little n is smaller than big n, so then that would be just you would get a smaller subset of that larger space. We're never going to talk about that setting throughout this talk. We're only going to talk about the case where little n is smaller than big n, so the underdetermined case, so where we make fewer measurements than the length of the signal. Okay, so that's K neighborliness. Here's theorem. And this is essentially the theorem which we just sketched by looking at those. The following two properties are equivalent. Okay. The convex hull of A, okay, so not being sloppy, let's say that this is A times Cn. What is Cn? Cn is the L1 ball. So we're looking at the convex hull of A, where now we're looking at all plus minus of all the columns, is essentially K neighborly. And so we changed this definition of neighborly. Well, why are we changing the definition of neighborly? Well, if we're including the vertex and minus's vertex as being vertices, so all the columns of A are going to be the vertices, and then we're including minus those as well, then this could never be two neighborly. Right? Because if you connected any two points, then you would get a line which went straight through the middle. So what we're going to do is change the definition to be centrally K neighborly, if we don't select any antipodal pairs. So we're picking these where the sigma i's minus 1 or plus 1, but we don't allow to pick two of them the same. So if essentially k neighborly, then here's the other part of the theorem. This is the part that we want for sparse approximation. Whenever b is equal to a, x naught as a solution, x naught, if at most k not zeros, says is, if you solve this problem, you will get back the sparsest solution, okay? Every time. So this connects the geometry. We saw that if it was neighborly, then the faces of those low dimensional, the k-dimensional faces of the unit ball were projected on the exterior. When we grew the polytope out, we would hit them and we would get the solution back to this. This is just a formal statement of that equivalence. So now, we should prove it. Although I think it's very clear geometrically, it would be nice to have something more than just a sketch with some plots. If there's any questions about this, by all means, please, please say something.
Okay.
So, when you say orthant, though, it doesn't mean that it has to be always positive, but some of them could be negative. One of the orthants, yes. Yeah. Exactly. Yes. So it has to be, so I should include is essentially k-neighborly with 2n vertices. And those vertices are going to be given by plus or minus ai, I equals 1 to a. Yeah. Okay. So everyone happy with this? Okay. So to prove this, we need two lemmas. And the lemmas are about uniqueness. Interpretation about this neighborliness as faces of the polytope. Okay, so let's begin with, why don't we begin with the uniqueness? So here's the uniqueness lemma. So consider F a K case of the convex hull of ACN, which is a simplex. Vertices of A, non-zeros only on the faces, the vertices of F.
Okay.
So we're saying it's on a face. It's a simplex. So it's very simple, just like on that plot we had at the polygon, and has a convex solution. Okay, fine. Then width, then X has. Okay. And converse is also true. So what this is saying is, once we're on one of those simplicity faces, then we have a unique representation. Okay. That's sort of obvious when you think about this plot. But for completeness, we should definitely say it. Okay. So if you're on one of these, here's a simplex, you're on that exterior, then you have a unique solution. Now, we also want to look at another lemma, which is going to change the problem from, instead of being about this neighborliness, right, this essentially neighborliness, instead to a question about each of the faces. And what that will allow us to do is talk about not just the case where it works all the time. This is a case where it works all the time, right, essentially k-neighborly, so all the faces are exterior. But we also want it to work, want to be able to talk about when it works some of the time. So we're going to be able to have a weaker version of this essentially k-neighborliness. And to do that, we need a lemma which connects the neighborliness with the number of faces. It's also a rather straightforward lemma. If you want to see a proof of one of these, just holler. We can do that. Talk about each of the faces instead. For all L, which goes from 1, from 0, up to k minus 1, then any face of dimension L, for all L, for all F, which is face of dimension L of Cn, so this means L dimensional face of the L1 ball. Okay, so Cn is just the L1 ball. That we have that AF is an L-dimensional face of the convex hull of A applied to Cn. So these two statements are equivalent. Can we walk through that one? It's late, so we can end sooner if we don't walk through, or we can walk through it. It's up to you. The enthusiasm does not seem very high. Okay. Well, let's not. We'll just go directly to the proof of the theorem, and we'll just sort of sketch it out.
Prove it like the Deakins will continue to
Yes, exactly. It's actually sort of like things won't continue if you don't want to prove it. Okay, so once we have these kind of statements, so first of all, we know that if it's on a case simplex, if it's on one of these faces, that it's going to be unique. Right? And we also know that if you have the faces, then that's equivalent to neighborliness. So remember the general theorem was going to say that it's neighborly, so that was here, and then it would always work. So essentially what the overall combination is, it's neighborly, which means it has these faces, okay? It's going to fall on one of those faces, and it's going to be unique. And we're going to be able to recover it using L1 minimization, which is more or less what you saw for those plots, the hand waving argument of showing the plots. Okay? So I think it would be instructive to at least sketch one of those. We'll call that the end of the first lecture. So let me restate the main theorem, and then we'll sketch in a little bit better detail the main theorem. So convex hull of ACN has two n vertices. One of these two directions. Let's go this way, since this may be the more interesting case.
Well, I think before you have this theorem, we should say that you get a solution which minimizes that, but
yes.
That problem may not have a unique solution.
Well, it is going to have a unique solution by our lemma that we had before. So that's going to come out connected with the fact that it's going to be essentially k-neighborhood.
The L1 problem may not have two solutions, right? It may have two solutions.
But it can't if it's centrally k-neighborhood. So you're thinking about a case which would look something like so let's imagine you had 3 points for a face. So there's a two-face. And then you had another two-face. Let's say those 3 points are in the board. You pick another point, which is interior to the board. That's what I mean by having it off-center. Now you can see why I didn't draw the other polytopes. So let's imagine that this is interior to the board. So there's an angle here which is not zero. Then, if you fall on this, it's going to be unique. Okay? However, if this is not interior, but if they are all coplanar, then it is not unique, right? But if you have that, then what happens? You're not going to have neighborliness working out. Okay, so let's sketch this forward direction from here to here. So we assume that x has k non-zeros. Okay. So what does that mean? Well, then, so this is our x naught. Because we're trying to prove this statement. So it has k non-zeros. And then we want to prove that it's the unique solution to that problem. Okay. So it has k non-zeros. Well, what that means is that it lives on f, which is a k-face of this convex hull. Uh, Fine. Well, if it's neighborly, by neighborliness, then what we know is that AF belongs to this convex hull of, that belongs to that. And then when we project it, it belongs to ACF. So the original the original vector is in the higher dimension, so it has to live on the L1 ball. Then when we apply A to that face, it has to live on the exterior. That's a result of the neighborliness and the connection with the number of faces. And then once we have that, then by uniqueness, B has a unique convex solution. Okay, well, we already have that solution. And it is x naught. The proof going the other direction is also quite similar. It's pretty straightforward, but you have to build up the fact that it's neighborly. So what you do is you start out by looking at x's, which have one non-zero, and from that it follows that this is going to have two n vertices. Once you know that it has two n vertices, then you can backtrack that in fact it has to actually be k-neighborhood. Okay. So let's call that good for the beginning. This first lecture was quite geometric, and hopefully this gives you some intuition as to when L1 minimization works and when it doesn't. That was the aim anyway. And then the second half of the lecture, we'll talk about the results that follow from this. Once you have these tools and you're able to understand when it does and doesn't work, then you can really go after the problem in quite a precise nature and get very precise bounds on when L1 minimization will give you this sparseness and when it will not. That's what we'll do in the second half.